Capo, Reel 7. You're describing your attack on the two Zeppelins near Hartford.
Yes. Yes. I might interpose just here a very interesting thing. Within a very short, I'll get back to the gun and the attack in a minute, but within very short time after this ZEP raid, we had on the station details of all the Zeppelins and even their skippers, which had been in the attack, which had been raiding London on this particular occasion. And the two which I had picked up at Hartford were the L-44, captained by Captain Lieutenant Stabbert, S-T-A-B-B-E-R-T, and L-52, captained by Oberlieutenant Zur C. Freibel, F-R-I-E-B-E-L, which I rather think was pretty good work for the intelligence of those days.
Have you any idea how they found out this information?
I haven't, but I can tell you another thing. This is getting a little bit out of sequence, this story. But I can tell you another thing, that what happened to these two Zeppelins is that one of them succeeded in getting home after the raid, and the other one apparently lost gas or something, but was flying around low down over France the following morning, apparently trying to wriggle its way home, and was shot down by the Frenchman from just a few hundred feet up. Or she crashed in France, I'm not quite sure. Now then, we'll go back to this attack of mine. Yes, I had fitted up my machine with a fixed gun of sorts, took off the windscreen, and instead of a windscreen on the cowling just in front of the pilot, the clip held the pistol grip of the Lewis gun, and the front end of the Lewis gun, the front end of the barrel, was held by some wire bracing, and at an angle which just cleared the tip of the prop. A very useful, one knew very well that one was much more likely to make any sort of an attack on anything from underneath it than from above it in a machine like the BE-2E. And so that gave one a handy position of a fixed gun firing just above the prop. We hadn't any interrupter guns at this time, of course, and a jolly useful gun. With the drum in a position where, from the pilot seat, you could very easily change it and stick on another one.
Mm-hmm. Were you flying in the front seat?
No. Flying in the normal pilot seat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just in the normal pilot seat. And in this particular machine of mine, I had the front seat cowled in, as a fact. Because I turned to myself, I got a rather weakness for doing these odd things myself around the squadron and altering the machines which Farnborough are kind enough to give us. I'd cowled in the front seat and fixed up with this special gun.
So the cowling was fixed on the gun was fixed on the cowling over this front seat.
No. The clip was right in, just in front of the pilot. You see, between the pilot and the observer, there's quite an extent of cowling, a couple of feet perhaps, between the pilot seat and the observer seat. Well, the pistol grip of the gun was a clip. You know where the windscreen, the pilot's windscreen is. Right. I had taken the pilot's windscreen off, and instead of that, I'd put this clip, which held the pistol grip of the gun, and the gun extended over the observer's seat.
Yes.
And there was, with some wire bracing, the nose of the gun held in a position where, as I say, it just cleared the tip.
So that it fired between the wings,
fired
between the two planes.
That's right, it fired under the top wing. and just clearing the circle of the arc of the arc of the propeller as the propeller goes
around.
Did you
have to do any ground trials with
oh,
this?
Oh Lord, yes.
Before.
Oh Lordy, Lordy, yes, yes.
Did you?
And get it down. You see, I wanted to get the gun. Well, the clip held the pistol grip in a fixed position, but the wire bracing could be altered by slackening this and tightening that, slackening this and tightening that. You could alter the position of the nose of the gun, bring it down quite a bit, or put it up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so, in getting this gun set up, I took the machine out onto the range, and got the tail hoisted up into the air so that the nose of the machine was well down and the gun was firing parallel to the ground onto a target. And by adjustment, by putting the propeller in such a place that the blade of the prop was vertical, and adjusting the gun until it just missed the top of the blade of the prop, I got the angle of the gun as near to horizontal as one could possibly do. It wasn't, I suppose, it was about 20 or 30 degrees above line of flight. But still, a very useful, a jolly useful gun, and particularly useful in these particular circumstances that just happened on this particular night. In fact, What happened was the Zeps were well above me, but as I was up there and I'd got some ammunition, that sort of thing, I might as well have a bang, and so I pushed off two or three drums in the direction. I won't say shot at them, because you don't shoot at something which is 2,000 or 3,000 feet above you. The best you can do is to shoot in that direction. And then in pulling the machine up in order to get my gun onto one, I got myself, I was in a semi-stalled position in any case, and fully stalled this darn thing. The nose went down with a crack, and I spun down for several thousand feet before I got out of it, by which time that was the end of the contest as far as I was concerned. But it is just interesting that one of these Zeps was flying very, very low over France the following day, and so it's just possible, I can't claim anything, but it seems to me, anyhow, whether it's whatever it seems to anyone else, it seems to me that quite likely that one of my drums or some of my shots might have gone into the bags and punctured the balloons and that sort of thing, and might have been the reason for getting caught over France.
Did the people in the squadron feel that such unsuccessful attacks were having a deterrent effect on the airship raids, or did you feel that you were sort of wasting your time and that you needed better equipment, better aircraft?
Ah, you could only have aircraft that were available. That's the whole point. You could only get. In fact, when I continue this story, you'll rather see the effect that this thing had, of altering this particular incident was instrumental in altering the equipment, bringing it to the notice of the top dogs, and altering the equipment which these squadrons had, bringing to their attention the fact that our equipment wasn't good enough for the job. But that's, I'll tell you that in a minute. So after this show, where we got to was spinning down out of control, getting into control eventually, and by that time the Zeps had gone away and it was a dark night and that sort of thing. Never find them again. And so there was just one thing to do, and that was to go home and have a noggin in the mess, which I did, and off to bed. I was hauled out of bed, however, fairly early, because the report had been phoned through to headquarters and so on. I was hauled out of bed fairly early with orders to go up and report the whole thing to headquarters. Now, headquarters was at this time, the wing headquarters. I'm not quite certain what things were called in these days, but we did have wing, yes. wing headquarters, which was at de Keyser's Hotel. There's something which has disappeared off the map altogether. In town, de Keyser's Hotel was a very big hotel at Blackfriars. It's disappeared nowadays altogether, but it was one of London's big hotels. I'll tell you where it is. If you come up the embankment, come along the embankment from Westminster direction, just before you arrive at Blackfriars, on the left-hand side is a white stone building, which is the City of London School, where I, as a fact, was at school. Then, at that time, you came onto a large block which extended right round the whole corner of Blackfriars, opposite Blackfriars Bridge, and that was de Keyser's Royal Hotel.
Now, it's where Spicer's paper.
Where Spicer's paper is today.
Yes.
Except that it's a different building. Mm-hmm. That's where Spicer's paper is today. You're quite right. And this was taken over by the army for various purposes. Amongst other things, was the headquarters of the wing, which 39 Squadron North Weald was one of its squadrons. And there I had all to go and report. The wing commander, as a fact, was a Colonel Higgins. Colonel Higgins brings forth the thing. I don't know whether it's worthwhile going back onto this, but in the fairly early days, at the time that I first got into the RFC, the RFC was getting, losing a lot of people in France, were getting desperate sort of chaps, desperately short of chaps, and so they were willing to take on to learn to fly anybody who was prepared to learn to fly. And at the same time, they were also going to be short of commanding officers, of admin officers and that sort of thing, and so they also had a lot of people who were regular army, came into the RFC in order to provide the upper grades. We were all right, people who were prepared to fly were all right as far as supplying the flying grades were concerned, but they wanted some admin grades. And going back at the time that I was at Dover, which I think is down onto this tape, there had been one or two people who were down there to learn to fly, Now then, the chaps, like myself, who had wings, were fully flying blokes and had wings, didn't have a great deal of time for these people who had not any wings, and at that time didn't mind saying so. And so there was the feeling between chaps who had wings and chaps who hadn't wings was at Dover was not so frightfully good. Well, one of these was a chap called Higgins. And the next time I came across Higgins was when he was my colonel. When he was my colonel at this incident, which I'm just recounting. And I went up to town with the probability of getting a little bit of a pat on the back, because at least I had a bang at a couple of Zeppelins and frightened them, if nothing else. But instead of collecting a pat on the back when I got there, it was quite the reverse. I was told that if only we people took more interest in what we were doing and took more interest in our machines and what was my valve clearance and that sort of thing. And generally speaking, ticking off because I had not been able to get any more than 12,000 feet. Nobody could get any more than 12,000 feet out of a 2E. Everybody knows that. Anyhow, I was ticked off for not having more than 12,000 feet and being able to get up to these Zeps at 15,000 feet, which is completely impossible in a TUI. And the interview finished up by saying, you will go to Whitehall and report to General Ashmore. General Ashmore was the general in complete control of the whole of London defence. He controlled not only the aircraft, the guns, the balloons. The whole thing, the whole of London defence was in the hands of Splash Ashlaw in Whitehall. And I'll tell you that from Blackfriars to Whitehall, I deliberately walked to spin the time out and trembling at every step. But and wondering what was going to happen to me when I got to Splash Ashmore. But as a hard fact, the reception which I got from Splash Ashmore was a different thing altogether. He was very sympathetic. Two of them, Chabot, a left and a right. By God, that was a position to be in, wasn't it? Grand. And so on and so on, rather that atmosphere. And then he said, "Now, wait a minute, will you?" And went away and came back after a little time. And he said, "Can you fly a Bristol fighter, Chabot?" I said, I've never seen a Bristol fighter, sir. He said, "I didn't ask you if you'd ever seen a Bristol fighter, Chabot. I said, can you fly one?" I said, "Well, I suppose I could, sir." "All right, I've just scrounged one from Salmon, and there are very few of them, but there's one at Northolt, which is waiting for you. My gin palace is outside, you can have that." A gin palace, I might tell you, was a Crossley limousine. The Flying Corps used Crossley for transport. Right through the whole organisation, we had Crossley.